The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Sharchak. With us this week in Are We Lucky is Blair Horner, the Executive Director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. Blair knows more about state politics than anybody I know, and anytime we can grab him, we grab him. He's back again. Welcome, Blair.
Thank you, Alan, and Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you. The way this year is going, we're going to need all the happies we can get.
That's exactly right. Fingers crossed. Hopefully this year is better than last.
That's right. But I don't have great hopes. Anyway, Blair Horner, State of the State. Let's start with that. New York Governor Kathy Hochul delivered her first State of the State address, outlining an agenda for an economic comeback from the COVID-19 pandemic and new government investments in healthcare, housing, and renewable energy. She spoke before a limited, sort of sad, socially distant audience in the Assembly. Very different from the kind of thing that Governor Cuomo had been doing in much expanded spaces. And she has got her troubles distancing from Cuomo, but at the same time getting closer to the legislature. Hochul is proposing a $10 billion plan to grow the state's healthcare workforce by 20% over the next 5 years, saying the pandemic worsened long simmering staffing problems. What do you make of the whole thing?
Well, as you correctly pointed out, I mean, it was a unique experience. Not in a sense, it was Back to the Future, where the governor held her State of the State address within the Assembly chamber, which, as you know, for decades had been the practice until former Governor Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo, started having them in the convention center, a bigger, more cavernous and more comfortable place for people to sit, and allowed him to do his now famous PowerPoints to go along with his presentation. This was, in a sense, sharing the stage with the legislature. And so in many ways, it was very symbolic and consistent with what had happened prior to Governor Cuomo. On the other hand, as you pointed out, it was unique because there had never been an assembly chamber that was so empty for a State of the State address. Usually in the old days, it was sort of cheek to jowl as people were jammed into the assembly chamber to hear the governor's State of the State address. And so it was different in that way. And I thought it made it harder for her at a certain level. I mean, she's doing her first State of the State address. Presumably, she was a little nervous about that. And there's none of the sort of the biofeedback that you get from speaking in front of an audience with the applauses and people, you know, really getting into it that gets usually the speaker's juices flowing. And so I thought she did a competent and confident job in terms of presenting. But it was uniquely strange and probably difficult for her to pull off.
You know, Blair, I've been assessing her work as competent, and some of the people around her don't like that. They think I should be saying excellent, not competent.
I'm sure they do.
Right. There's nothing wrong with the word competent, is there?
No. I mean, in fact, that's what you want in public service. You want competent, professional, skilled people doing their job, and doing it, based on the public's interest, not their own interests, which is what landed the previous governor into trouble. I think that's exactly, again, it was unique. It was a woman, right? So as we said, that had never happened before. And there was this sort of strange environment in which she had to operate, which I thought under the circumstances, she did a good job. But in terms of the policies, she had a big advantage, which her predecessor really hadn't had in years, which is a budget flush with cash. And so that allows her to offer these initiatives respond to some of the festering problems facing the state. Now, again, the federal money runs out at some point, and so that can't last forever. But but it can certainly last for this year. And this year is the big year for her because she's running for governor.
You know, Blair Horner, I was very interested in when the speech was over, there was massive applause from a handful of people. I can't put it better than that. Almost as if they had been instructed to really let loose. But it did look a little phony to me. I don't know. You know, you had an almost empty assembly chamber. You had a group of her people sitting up there. She says it's going to be different from the old Andrew days. But, you know, I smelled a sort of, you know, this is what we're going to do, folks, coming from the top.
Well, you know, I mean, every State of the State address, there's a response by the governor's team. And I say that writ large, not just staff, but usually anybody in the same political party, to sort of bump up the volume. And that contributed to her State of the State address being on the short side. It was around a half an hour, more than half an hour long. Normally, governors over time, their first speeches tend to be the shortest. And over time, they spend more and more time congratulating themselves. And that takes up time in the State of the State address. She didn't, you know, it's her first time, so she didn't have a lot to say about her track record, a four-month track record as governor. But, you know, everyone wants to sort of be supportive. And the Democratic political establishment is largely lined up behind her. And so I think they understood by sitting in the room that this was unique and that they wanted to sort of, you know, give a positive response despite the sort of paucity of attendance.
Let's talk a little bit about health care. You know, as I've suggested, she's proposing a $10 billion plan to grow the state's health care workforce by 20% over the next 5 years, saying the pandemic worsened long simmering staffing problems. Why the emphasis now? Is it COVID?
Yeah. I mean, this really is part of her COVID response. It's the centerpiece of a COVID response because there are increasingly colleges all across New York State are developing healthcare programs. For example, in the Capital District in New York, Siena College, which has been long known as a small liberal arts college, now has a nursing program. And so there's a pipeline that's developed to fill the needs. And there's been, going back to the Pataki era, back 20 years, a concern about a nursing shortage. And so I think, you know, it was a real problem. The quality of care in New York State hospitals tends to be among the worst in the country, ironically. And so there's a real need to sort of fix health care. And the COVID pandemic has sort of made all that worse because, you know, if you're jamming people into conference rooms to deal with ICU problems for COVID patients and others, cancer patients, and others can't get in the hospital, I mean, there's a serious problem across the board. So she addresses it head on with a significant, you know, proposal that talks about using a lot of money over a five-year period, which isn't that long, but it's not tomorrow either. And so I think that was a way for her to shape the response in sort of a systemic way to not only COVID, which is going to be with us for a while, but also the other problems that are festering in New York State. So I thought it was a smart way to have, organize her response to COVID and healthcare, because everybody thinks about that. But again, you don't know what the details are until the budget comes out, which is really where the prose is. Yesterday was the poetry. I mean, this is really about, what her vision is, but the details really matter. I mean, $10 billion is not a drop in the bucket, and the state really needs to know how that money is going to get spent to not only improve staffing, but also quality of care in hospitals and other healthcare settings.
Blair Horner, you are, of course, our ethics specialist. She proposes ethics reform, obviously in response to Cuomo's tenure, JCOP, or the attempt to sort of have an oversight body, miserably failed. It was Cuomo's commission. We all know that. So she comes up with something else. Want to talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, she had a package of things sort of put together. She proposed term limits, which was a response to, you know, her predecessor's interest in running for a fourth term. She proposes a term limit of two terms for members of the executive branch. She bans outside income for members of the executive branch in her proposal, which is a direct sort of response to Cuomo's two book deals, which total upwards to $6 million into his pocket. And she also proposes to blow up the state's ethics watchdog, the Joint Commission on Public Ethics, and replace it with something new. And what she proposed in the State of the State, you know, it's, again, it's like two sentences, right? So we don't really know what it's going to look like until you see the budget. But she proposes some version where the reliance of oversight will come from law school deans. And so how that's going to work, she says they're going to have to be a rotating basis, how they get picked, how you do the rotation, how you insulate those people from political pressure when they live in they work in institutions that are regulated by the state, and what institutions that lobby the state, the ethics watchdog oversees lobbying industry too, like how she's going to deal with all that stuff, I think are really in key details that we don't know. But it certainly met what she said. She wanted to blow up the Joint Commission on Public Ethics, which she proposes to do, and replace it where lawmakers aren't making the direct appointees to the ethics watchdog, which is what she proposes to do. How her idea sort of plays out, I think, we'll get a better sense in a couple of weeks, but it is a sort of daunting task to put together what I just described, although it's an interesting idea. We'll see how she proposes to make it work.
I worked for the New York City Police Commissioner years and years ago, and I brought all of the deans of the various schools of social work in for a plan to put social workers in precincts, and they began to fight with each other. You know, that was pretty interesting. And as we all know, the definition of a dean is a mouse studying to be a rat. So we don't really...
Alan was speaking for Alan, not for Blair.
But we do know that we are at a point now where something's got to get done. The question is, if we were looking at Speaker Hastie during all of this, how much does he like? Because if you're going to impose ethics rules on the executive, how far behind can, you know, term limits and things like that be for the New York State Legislature, which, in my opinion, really needs them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that whether or not the term limits and outside income ban survive the legislative process is going to be tricky, because the ban on outside income is relatively straightforward. You could do that in a bill. The executive branch is not supposed to have outside income as it is. This merely just shuts. And the only reason the governor, former governor, was able to get those two book deals is because the Joint Commission just rolled over for him. But in a normal functioning democracy, he wouldn't have gotten those agreements, in my opinion. But the term limits is a constitutional amendment, which means it has to pass two successive legislatures and be approved by the voters. And the fastest that that could happen is 2024. So the legislature could easily approve it one time and then have amnesia the second. I mean, that wouldn't be the first time that's happened. So yeah. I think that there will be some sort of pushback, both ideologically on those lawmakers who don't agree with term limits, as well as sort of functionally, that they're worried about the camel's nose coming under the tent.
Very, very interesting. The question that I raised earlier is about Speaker Hastie and defending the legislature, because after all, he speaks for the people in his house, Stuart Cousins in the Senate. How likely are they to see this as a challenge to their ultimate longevity?
Yeah, I think the governor was careful to design it to make the most controversial elements, the outside income and term limits, be exclusively on the executive branch. Now, maybe Tom DiNapoli and Tish James don't like that, but the legislature at a certain level could care less. If you boil it down to its essential politics, and that's how leaders work in the legislature and in politics generally, it doesn't affect them. And so if they're sort of lining up behind Governor Hochul in her election effort anyway, why not throw her the bone? And as I mentioned earlier on the constitutional amendment, they still get a second bite at the apple in 2023 if they choose to do that. And so, you know, I think that there's a way for them to sort of look at this and not view it as a real threat to their own activities. Former Governor Cuomo, for example, was trying to ban outside income from the legislative branch, and Governor Hochul noticeably did not, as I understand it, apply that to the legislative branch. And so maybe they'll just decide to let it go.
Well, we'll see. That's a big maybe. My experience watching these folks has always been that they do what's best for them, and they see the train coming down the track when it offers a threat to them. But who knows? We'll see. Let's talk about the environment. What'd you see there?
Well, I thought the governor had a lot of interesting proposals to deal with sort of climate change in particular. I mean, she talked a lot about a big boost in essentially changing the way the state's building codes work so that the future of buildings in New York State is going to be ones where those buildings are powered by electricity, not powered by fossil fuel. And there had been a sort of festering controversy, particularly downstate, where developers were arguing unless they got natural gas pipeline hookups to their buildings, it was hurting economic development, which, of course, if you think about it, that sounds interesting. But you think about it for 2 seconds, you're like, well, there's all these power lines all over the place. Why can't you rely on them? New York City, at the end of last calendar year, passed a bill saying all new buildings, starting, I believe, in 2024, are going to have to be constructed relying on power from electricity. And while right now most of New York State's electricity comes from fossil fuels, the theory is over time you're going to rely less and less on that, and you'll rely more on solar and wind, which the governor talked about, geothermal and other renewable sources. So that was really interesting and new. Also, she talked about pushing for enhanced use of electric vehicles generally. And Governor Cuomo had promised about 8 years ago that we're going to have nearly a million electric cars on the roads in New York State by the year 2025. We're nowhere near that. And so there really needs to be policies to deal with it. So there was interesting, I thought, environmental proposals in that way. I mean, she sort of skirted past some of the sort of right now contested issues around crypto mining, for example, which uses tremendous amounts of electricity. She talked about the solid waste issues and saying that the producers, not the taxpayers, should pay for recycling, but how that's going to work out. She doesn't mention the state's bottle law, for example, which is 40th anniversary this year, which has been hugely successful, not perfect, but successful. She didn't mention that at all. So there was something she omitted from her presentation, but she had some really innovative and interesting ideas, particularly in electrification of New York State's sort of economic development and transportation sectors.
Now, Blair Horner, where were the Republicans? As everybody heard the speech, clearly they weren't happy, but there's such a small minority at this point of the game in terms of power. What could they say? What could they do?
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, every State of the State address, typically the party out of power will bang around on the issues that they really care about. But there's not a whole lot to say because the devil is in the details and there's no details. So in this case, I mean, I watched Senator Wirtz's news conference as Senate Minority Leader, and where they're really focusing their energies was on sort of the issues that came up in the local elections mm-hmm. in 2021 dealing with criminal justice issues and the no cash bail and some of the other issues that they find that they're opposed to and that they think spurs crime. And so the governor really didn't talk much about that. She talked about gun violence. She sort of, it was interesting the way she dealt with those issues. She would talk about it sort of tangentially, but she didn't really address some of the bail reform issues head on. And that's really where the Republicans were focusing their fire. I think where we're going to see them most ferociously will be when the budget comes out, because there will be distinct policy differences. And I think they're sort of, to some extent, terrified by what's going to happen with the redistricting process, because there may be even fewer of them when the Democrats get done drawing the lines.
Well, let's go there, Blair Horner. What are you hearing about what the reapportionment of our congressional and state legislative districts are going to look like?
Well, you know, this is another one of the failed reforms that were initiated by the former governor. As you may recall, about nearly 10 years ago, the governor advanced redistricting reforms in the state constitution as part of a deal where he agreed to some of the most gerrymandered maps I'd ever seen for the legislature for the 2014 elections. The changes were approved by voters, and so the state constitution says that it's this independent redistricting commission. And it turned out, of course, it's nothing like that. And so Democrats came up on the commission with their own maps, Republicans on the commission came up with their own maps. And so it's a sort of muddied process right now as to how the lines will work out. But the Constitution allows the legislature to ultimately approve their own lines if that's what they choose to do. And it's, you know, again, this is a first time through the box process, so God knows how it'll play out. But so far, it looks like the Democrats are, you know, sort of steering the ship toward them being able to draw their own lines. And if that's the case, Republican incumbents will face more difficulties than not. I mean, if there appears to be some agreement. New York State has to lose one congressional seat, for example. It's a one area where there appears to be some real effort is to combine the Catco and Penny districts in central New York, both Republicans, as a way to sort of lose a seat by merging the two of those incumbents together for a fair fight between the two of them, and at the same time carve up the other districts in a way I think that are most advantageous to Democrats, although there will be Republicans, obviously, that will win, but there are parts of the state where Republicans are quite strong. But it's certainly looking to me like the way that the ship is heading, the redistricting ship, is one that's going to benefit Democrats.
Let's talk about one of your real areas of expertise. Not that you're not an expert in all of these, and we so appreciate it, Blair, but higher education. Let's talk about what you gleaned out of that speech that might affect your mass constituency, consisting in many ways of students.
Yeah, I mean, one of the issues where the governor, I thought, faced a real challenge and will with her budget is, what do you do about the higher education sector in New York State? Outside of the big universities, both public and private, which are doing, you know, reasonably well financially, the four-year public colleges, the two-year community colleges, and to some extent the small four-year liberal arts independent sector colleges are all facing serious financial problems. I mean, there's been a hemorrhaging of student enrollment in the public colleges, particularly the four-year comprehensive, so-called comprehensive colleges, and the two-year community colleges. Huge, huge, huge drop off in enrollment. And so, you know, it's not only about educating people. You know, I mean, it's also a lot of these colleges, particularly in upstate, are the economic engines of their little communities. I mean, if you think about what would Cortland be like if it wasn't for SUNY Cortland, you know, it's already a tough area. It would be a lot tougher.
Do we know, Blair, why this drop-off in enrollment?
Well, I, you know, to some extent, it's a function of demography, right? I mean, the 18 to 24-year-old population in upstate New York is dropping off. And historically, those upstate schools relied on downstate immigrants to go to college up there. New York State's population appears to be declining, largely due to the shutoff in immigration that occurred under the Trump administration. That's how New York used to keep its population growing, was really through immigration. And so the changing demographics, New York State is getting to be an older state, and that was reflected in the governor's sort of master plan on aging. And so I think it's a lot of it's demography. A lot of it is, you know, is the higher education, are the higher education institutions appealing to wannabe students in high school? So it's a combination of things that I think the state has to sort of address. And the heavy reliance on forcing the students to pay more for these institutions and the public sector, I think, has sort of backfired. So I think the governor needs to sort of infuse cash. She talked about it to some extent, really, though, on the university side, where she talked about making University of Buffalo and Stony Brook flagship institutions for the state university system. And she talked about expanding TAP to non-traditional students, tuition assistance program, which makes sense. You want to bring in new students, right? You need enrollments to go up. But she didn't really tackle some of the issues, the sort of systemic issues, like the financial needs of the institutions themselves. She didn't really talk about the independent sector at all. And so I think we're going to have to see what happens with that stuff when the budget gets unveiled, because if those institutions wither on the vine, it's going to not only be a setback for college students to get a diversity of educational experiences, but it's really going to hurt particularly the upstate economies.
So those independent sectors, we used to call them private colleges, we don't do that anymore, and they're in trouble. In the old days, it was sort of tit for tat between the public and private, but you use the term withered on the vine. When we see lists published of who's in trouble, they're among the most troubled.
That's right. That's exactly right. And to some extent, it's also because the state's been pulling back. The state's been pulling back support for the public sector, but also the private sector. The independent colleges used to get more financial aid for their students from the state's tuition assistance program. And the former governor Cuomo severed that relationship. And that's, I think, hurt them. The state used to have something called, still has, a program called Bundy Aid, which was basically unrestricted financial aid for the independent sector. And that program's been cut back. And Governor Cuomo a few times even tried to zero it out. And so that pullback in state aid, I think, has hurt the finances, particularly the smallest independent colleges that don't have big endowments to rely on. And in a sense, they're mirror images of the problems facing the smaller four-year public colleges as well, because there's a changing demographic. There's no getting around that. And the pullback in state financial aid, I think, makes the financial assistance, not just aid, makes all of those institutions' finances more threadbare. And some of them are on the ropes. I mean, some of the independent colleges are either on the verge of or have shut down. On the state, on the public side, that hasn't happened yet. But some of these community colleges have had like 50% declines in enrollment. Yeah. And you still have the same amount of buildings. You still have the same amount of faculty. How do you keep that business model going without state support? I don't know.
Well, my wonderful friend Blair, we are out of time. For all of you who have been listening, our guest has been Blair Horner, who I consider to be the top expert on New York State politics and so many other politics. He's the executive director for NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group. Blair, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Or visit us online anytime at WAMC.org, or you can even schedule a podcast. Ask for program number 2201. And join us again next week at this same time for another Political Conversation with Alan Chartok. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.